Chairman of the Board of Trustees of Asia House, Sir John Boyd and Lady Boyd, Trustees of Asia House. I was about to say the Right Honourable Hugo Swa, but he has a pressing business to go elsewhere, so I'll address him in absence. Excellencies, Lords, friends, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very happy to be here tonight in this historical and very beautiful building. Although it's been associated with some interesting events in the past of Britain. Well, first, let me thank the trustees of Asia House for their kind and gracious award. I'm very much honoured to accept it as a recognition of Temasek, and more importantly, the Temasek team, past and present. As you know, I come from Singapore. It's a small little island. So I thought, as we relaxed among friends this evening, please allow me to share a little of the story of Singapore and Temasek with you. Singapore was already known in the second century to the Roman Greco world as a trading post. Ptolemy named it Sabana. Third century merchants from China call it Pulo Chong, the island at the end. This little island is much, much smaller than Britain, the island at the other end of the world in the west. In fact, Singapore is less than half the size of London. In 1819, nearly 200 years ago, Sir Stamford Raffles took over Singapore towards the tail end of the Anglo-Dutch spice trade tussle in the Far East. This little island trading post grew quickly, and Singapore was soon firmly anchored into the British Empire by the Anglo-Dutch Treaty of 1824. Seems very long ago. Fast forward another 120 years to the end of World War II, Britain began to devolve its colonial powers through various forms of self-government around the world. The first Singapore municipal elections were held in 1948. Some 11 years later, in 1959, Singapore was granted the first full self-government, with her own head of state in place of the British governor. Defence and foreign affairs remain under British charge, with the headquarters of the British Far East Forces centred in Singapore. The newly elected Singapore government in 1959 soon discovered, to their utter dismay, that they were staring at a budget deficit of some 14 million Singapore dollars for the year. The government kitty had also been emptied by the predecessor government to the tune of some 10% of the island's GDP of about £250 million. The newly minted prime minister and his new finance minister went to work with a vengeance. They cut their own salaries by almost a quarter. Allowances of top civil servants were also reduced. Projects were shelved. It was an all-out effort and push to reduce deficit for the year. It was not an easy time. Emotions ran high, as you can imagine, with this unprecedented salary reduction. But logic and example prevailed, and the civil service pulled together. By the end of the year, the finance minister reported proudly of a surplus of 1 million Singapore dollars. This surplus in the first year of self-government set the tone and timber for fiscal prudence and budget discipline for successive governments to come. Next came the 1965 crisis, or nationhood development. This time, Singapore found itself bereft of a large hinterland overnight after the short-lived merger with Malaysia. This left the tiny and newly independent nation scrambling and scrabbling for a living and for living space. Per capita income was all of 1,600 Singapore dollars, and it was about 184 pounds in those days. Average life expectancy was a little over 64 years. But troubles never come singly. In the late 1967, barely 2 years into Singapore's independence, Britain, facing her own financial crisis, decided to cut spending by withdrawing her military forces east of the Suez by 1971. The British forces in Singapore were not just a security umbrella for trade to flow freely through the Straits of Malacca through the east. They also accounted for some 20% of Singapore's GDP and were the largest single source of employment on the island. No wonder few in those days gave Singapore any odds to survive on her own. It had, and it has, no mineral wealth, little water, and no hinterland to speak of. It was just a trading post, dependent on port trade, with almost no industries. And 20% of its GDP, as well as jobs, would soon be gone. A massive manpower conversion program was started immediately to train base personnel for new jobs. Swamps were drained to make new industrial town for factories to make up for the withdrawal of the British forces. Young investment promotion officers were soon buttonholing dinner guests in the Philippines, the US, in Japan, in Britain itself, and in Europe to invest in Singapore. The government was prepared to provide loans or put in risk capital as a co-investor to encourage the likes of Cerebos, a chicken essence producer from the UK, to start up plants and create new jobs for her people. British naval dockyards were converted to ship repair yards so that workers could retain their jobs. Military electrical workshops were transformed into electrical services companies. Yet, in the midst of the desperate drive to attract investments and create jobs, Singapore saw how choking pollution and tearing smog were engulfing cities in the US, like Los Angeles, in Europe, and in Japan. And so in 1970, barely 5 years after independence, Singapore set up an air pollution unit reporting directly to the Prime Minister. The government was prepared to lose investments which didn't comply with the standards for clean air. Even as we strove for survival, we wanted to make sure we didn't pollute or despoil our air, water, and land for our people and our future generations. Our resolution was tested early. When Singapore was bidding for petrochemical investment against strong international competition, the government required the potential investor to install scrubbers to minimize pollution, even at the risk of losing that investment. The scrubbers were duly installed. When 1971 arrived, the island hummed with companies big and small. Factories, local and foreign, were busy producing for the world. There was no massive unemployment from the British pullout. And so there was a collective sigh of relief. That year, 1971, also saw our first annual tree planting day. It was a symbolic but also very important commitment to keep our environment clean and green. Industrialization in our minds was to go hand in hand with green, beautiful nature for our people and children. 9 years into independence, as Singapore emerged from a series of crises, the government found itself to be an owner of a smorgasbord of companies. Government loans for businesses had already been spun out earlier to form the Development Bank of Singapore, today the DBS, largest bank in Southeast Asia. It was not the business of government to be looking after shares and investments in businesses and companies. These range from minority shares in a hotel to a wholly owned bird park, from a co-investment in a commercial detergent maker to an innovative open concept zoo as a wholly owned public good. And so Temasek was formed in 1974 to take over this mixed bag of companies and investments from a golf shoemaker to Cerebos, the chicken essence producer from UK. While Temasek didn't start with a blueprint or a grand master plan, its very name, Temasek, was an old name for Singapore. The ethos of Temasek was already shaped at birth by the post-war history of Singapore. to live within our means and be financially disciplined, to do the right things with tomorrow clearly in our minds, particularly for our future generations, to make sure that our drive for survival and prosperity go hand in hand with the respect and nurturing of a clean and green environment for our people. From the start, the government took a hands-off approach to Temasek. Subsidies were most definitely out of the question. Companies in our portfolio were allowed to fail, as the Gough shoemaker did subsequently. Neither Temasek nor the government would be there to bail them out. With that accountability came the responsibility to make their own decisions. The government, and it took discipline on their part, played no part in the commercial decisions of the companies, and likewise Temasek. Take Singapore Airlines, for instance, or SIA as we call it in Singapore. From day one, SIA knew it had to innovate and compete internationally or fold. After all, there was not much domestic air traffic opportunity for an island that is all of 30 miles at its widest span, just a little further than a marathon run. SIA never had to ask Temasek, much less the government, whether it should buy Boeing or Airbus planes, or whether it should add or withdraw capacities in particular routes. SIA made its own commercial decisions as an airline company. Few of its international competitors in the airline industry operate with such commercial independence away from government subvention and influence even today. The greatest gift at birth from the Singapore government to SIA was to help negotiate with the British government then for air rights. Indeed, SIA's success today owes much to the UK government's early approval for it to fly to London at its very start. The second gift from the Singapore government was to run a clean and lean government and an efficient economy that is well plugged into the global market. And so SIA had the freedom to become a global pace setter. It changed the norms and standards for airline travel. If I remember correctly, it was the first airline in the world to offer free alcohol on the flights. And so, SIA managed to thrive and grow with Singapore. Singapore Airlines is but one of the many examples of our portfolio companies that have succeeded through innovation and sheer determination and not state support. Many of these companies grew with Singapore's transformation, and Temasek grew with them. The path has not always been smooth. Whenever economic storms threaten, management in Temasek set an example by reducing their own salaries, no different from what the first self-government of Singapore did. The most recent was during the global financial crisis of 2008. Temasek senior management volunteered cuts of up to 25%, while junior staff took smaller cuts. It was a show of solidarity to be ready for rough weather, but it also served as a sharp, quick signal to the rest of the Temasek portfolio companies in Singapore to be prepared for the very rough weather ahead. It was this collective drive for survival and a commitment to the long term that enabled Temasek and the Temasek portfolio companies to survive and thrive. And the old British naval and harbour yards, well, the two competing yards, one a formal naval dockyard and the other a former harbour board repair yard, have today become the leading deep water rig builders in the world. They built the three rigs which successfully plugged the oil gush of the 2010 Gulf of Mexico spill. One of them, Keppel Offshore Marine, based just 1 degree north of the equator, also built icebreakers for Russia's Arctic operations. I thought I found that very interesting. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, this year Temasek is celebrating its 40th anniversary. We have tried to capture the spirit of Temasek in our Temasek Charter as an active investor and long-term shareholder, as a forward-looking institution, and above all, as a trusted steward. Meritocracy and integrity, as Stuart has mentioned just now, are our watchwords. We invest in businesses which operate and compete effectively for the long term and not take shortcuts at the expense of the community at large. These ideas and ideals influence our thinking from the earliest days about our roles and responsibilities for the long term. For instance, we puzzled over how we can foster an owner's mindset in Temasek. We mulled over various ideas and decided some 10 years ago to introduce deferred compensation plans linked to risk-adjusted returns. For our senior folks, a substantial part of our bonuses and incentives are deferred for as long as 12 years, or about two business cycles. This aims to foster a long-term ownership mindset. If the returns are not sustained, we share negative bonuses. In other words, bonus clawbacks. In so doing, we try to align the interests and behavior towards long-term ownership. We engage our portfolio companies and other stakeholders around the world with a view to fostering good governance. These are unusual disciplines to which we subject ourselves in order to build the institution for the long term. Underlying these various systems and initiatives is the idea that we work for a better tomorrow as a responsible and trusted steward. Businesses do not exist in isolation from the society or the communities, nor the forces that shape us all. Much like Britain had supported Singaporeans in our early days through programs such as the Colombo Plan scholarships, we too hope to play our part as a responsible stakeholder and a trusted steward in and outside of Singapore. Thus, 10 years ago, we committed to set aside a portion of our returns above our risk-adjusted hurdle. This was to be used to uplift the community at large, particularly in a developing Asia. To date, we have established and sponsored 16 community endowments, each with specific mandates to build people, to build capabilities, to build bridges between diverse communities, and to rebuild lives. These endowments are driven by separate, independent, and passionate, thoughtful teams. From funding less glamorous research into mental health or Parkinson's disease, to developing pilot programs to support aging in place. From lending a helping hand to caregivers, single parents, and traumatized children, to programs for disaster recovery and rebuilding lives. From bringing together youth across a diverse Asia to learn and grow together, to programs on governance and town planning for civil servants from around Asia. These are but a small sliver of what the various endowment staff have done to touch the lives of over 170,000 people across Asia over the last decade. Friends, ladies and gentlemen, Singapore will be celebrating its 50th year of independence next year. It has been a journey which has made a difference to the lives of our people. In less than five decades, per capita GDP has grown over 100 times in US dollar terms. Life expectancy went from less than 65 years in 1965 to over 82 years last year. As you can see, we may have owed our success to that fateful decision to withdraw British forces from Singapore by 1971. That decision forced us to innovate and industrialize at great pace. Temasek, at 40 this year, is part of the Singapore story. Our journey has just begun. We will yet again embark on a new journey of change and challenge, but also of hope and opportunity. As we face the uncertain world of change and the exciting challenge of the digital age, I do hope that Singapore and Temasek will have the honor and privilege to work with many of you here to make a difference, to bring about a better and kinder world, a more sustainable and thoughtful world, and above all, a more peaceful, compassionate, and inclusive world. Thank you.